Being an Epicurean in today's world comes with connotations of people who value fine food and fine drink, and, well, it gets a bit unclear after that. So it's a good thing we have modern philosophers who can not only explain the thinking of Epicurus, but demonstrate how to live as an Epicurean. Catherine Wilson does just that in her book, How to Be an Epicurean, The Ancient Art of Living Well. Catherine Wilson is a philosopher with a long resume in teaching at universities in several countries. She also has a long list of published works, including 8 previous books. One of those is a very short introduction to Epicureanism. Catherine Wilson, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
So we're moving beyond a short introduction, I gather, in this volume.
That's right. I was really surprised at how long this book turned out to be, because when my agent proposed it to me, I thought, oh, gosh, I've written a scholarly book on Epicureanism. I've written a very short introduction. What am I going to say now? But once I started writing, turned out that I wrote 300 pages or so.
All right. But it's a good read. It moves along fairly well, I must say. The first paragraph of the preface frames the philosophy or the thinking of philosophy itself. It is both exalted and execrated, it seems like, in today's world.
That's right. As you pointed out, most people think that Epicureanism has something to do with food and drink. It's high living, maybe it's gluttony, all sorts of self-indulgence. But of course, once you get into the book, you see that that's not really what it's all about.
And just to philosophy more generally, beyond just Epicureanism, a point that you and other philosophers have made here, it's not just old thinking, but very much alive and useful to our time.
That's right. I think ancient philosophy is really enjoying a comeback. And that's because it speaks directly to people's experiences and problems. And much moral philosophy that we do in universities has become really technical and really quite difficult to understand unless you're immersed in it in a specialist way. Of course, people get a lot of pleasure out of that, and quite useful results come from it. But I think there's an interest in amongst the reading public and the thinking public and the listening public in understanding philosophy and how it relates to people's own lives.
Catherine, does any of Epicurus's own writing survive, or is it all interpreted later by other writers?
That's a very good question. It survives. It survives because it was copied down and transmitted in a few forms. They're so-called Vatican sayings that actually ended up in the Vatican. But Epicurus himself wrote, I think, 37 books in the ancient philosophy sense, that have largely disappeared. A lot of those manuscripts were buried by the eruption of Vesuvius. And now they're being unrolled and restored, and they're partially legible, so they're actually being reconstructed. But most of what we know comes to us through Lucretius, who did have those texts. Now, Lucretius was a Roman poet in the first century BCE, and he wrote this fantastic poem on the nature of things that was drawing on these lost manuscripts of Epicurus.
But he was writing, what, 2 centuries then after
yes,
Epicurus?
That's right, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I'm curious to know why it's still called Epicureanism and why it isn't called Lucretianism instead.
Well, Epicurus, he was the one with the ideas, and Lucretius transformed them into beautiful Latin verse and added a few twists of his own, I think.
All right. So you mentioned the idea that Epicureanism is often seen as gluttony or something, or just encouraging people to eat, drink, and be merry. What do you think is the source that steers people wrong on Epicureanism?
Well, I think Epicureanism did somehow get partially degraded, and partially just lost. Over the course of especially the 18th and 19th century. So people kind of forgot when lots of the ideas of Epicureanism just passed into the mainstream that it actually was a very radical and very comprehensive philosophy at the beginning. So things we take for granted now, theory of evolution, the existence of atoms, welfare as something that we should be politically struggling for. And even the history of humanity, these were really radical ideas when the Epicureans first brought them out. But now we just, a lot of us anyway, take them for granted, and we forgot that they had this source in ancient philosophy.
And I want to pick up on the points you mentioned, Adam's welfare, history of humanity, but just your own motivation first, though. What produces your own sense of urgency in presenting Epicureanism as a choice to today's world?
Well, I think that a lot of people are interested in how can they make their lives better, how can they reduce stress, how can they become happier, and I think there's a lot of snake oil peddled that isn't really steering people right, and that what we need is not more life hacks and tips and people's intuitive ideas, but something that gives us a framework to make decisions from. And that's where philosophy comes in.
So not just a quick trick or, 10 ways to make your day better. We're talking about a deeper sort of an actual philosophy. That's what it is.
Exactly. Yeah.
The book is called How to Be an Epicurean, The Ancient Art of Living Well. It is the work of Catherine Wilson, building upon the work of Epicurus back in the 3rd century BCE and the rewriting in the 1st century BCE by Titus Carus Lucretius, a Roman. Epicurus was from Athens. Catherine, you say that Epicureanism is an optimistic philosophy, but not to the point of rose-colored glasses.
That's a fair description, I suppose. One difference between Epicureanism and Stoicism, and there are a lot of differences, is that the Stoic tends to expect the worst and to suppose that philosophy ought to be preparing you for the disasters that are inevitably going to happen, whereas Epicureanism stresses looking out for ways to avoid disasters that would otherwise happen by limiting your ambitions, by looking for ways to reduce stress, and by looking for ways just to make things in your life more beautiful and comfortable and attractive and easy.
So not quite about pleasure above all other goals. It's a bit more nuanced than that, you're saying.
Avoidance of pain is actually more important than pursuit of pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and this is a key to philosophy, as we learn in the book, that the things that you choose and the things that you avoid, and I'm curious too about this particular part of it, about the avoidance of pain, that Epicurus seemed to anticipate, among other things, Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs. I mean, you really sort of look to your own well-being first, don't you?
That's right. Epicurus says so. The worst things are to be cold and hungry. And, of course, in physical pain or even in mental pain. But after that, he thought, we need friends, not just because something terrible might happen to us and the friends will come to our aid, but because of the pleasure we get from conversing with people, sharing ideas with them, sharing perceptions with them. He also thought we need to study nature, understand nature, live in the midst of nature. And he thought we also needed to have intimate relationships with people. That was a real source of satisfaction as far as he was concerned. But he thought or at least Lucretius thought, we have to be careful about disappointment in love.
Is it easy or difficult to tell from the writing which stuff actually came directly from Epicurus and which was Lucretius providing a bit of interpretation?
Yes. There's a good book about this by David Sedley, who does try to explore what Lucretius took and what he modified. But really, we see it all as part of the same tradition. For scholars, that's an important question, but not so much from the perspective of this book.
Okay. Well, I had an oh yeah moment remembering from reading your book that philosophy was a much broader thing back in the time of Epicurus, that it encompassed a lot more fields that we would consider now separate, like science, for example.
Absolutely. There's cosmology, psychology, theory of perception, epistemology, what we can know. There's a critique of religion, especially in Lucretius. It's really pretty fierce. And the very famous Epicurean account of death and how we should think about death.
All right, so we'll get at all these in turn. We do start with physics, and you mentioned this already. The Epicurus talked about atoms back then.
Yes, amazing that they deduced by a combination of pure reason and observation that the world must be made up of little material particles, as they saw it. It isn't exactly how we think of the atom today, but there's a historical connection all the way down to contemporary physics from ancient Epicureanism.
So what does it mean that we are collections of atoms perceiving other collections of atoms?
Yes, that's right. So even the soul or the mind was atomic for Epicurus and Lucretius. They thought there were especially fine, subtle, slippery atoms that pervaded the whole body. And through their activity, we were able to think and feel and perceive.
So that it was a function of atoms then, that we had souls or minds or something.
Right, mm-hmm. Because that was all there was in the universe, atoms, void, and their motion.
Catherine Wilson is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a philosopher and author of How to Be an Epicurean, The Ancient Art of Living Well. Now, here's where Epicurus parted ways with modern physics. He apparently did not believe in a Big Bang or similar starting event to the universe.
That's right. The atoms had always existed and would always exist. They were the only eternal things in the universe. Everything else was transitory.
Wow. And so then what did Epicurus think about deities and their place in this universe?
He's a little cagey on that. He says that the gods exist because everyone believes them to exist, but he describes them as living outside our cosmos, in their own cosmos, and having absolutely no interest in our world, and certainly not intervening in it. So very different from the religious views of other ancient philosophers and, of course, all modern religions. Modern religions.
Okay. Did he not see the gods as creators then, like the whole God the Watchmaker idea?
Right. Yeah. That was that was a Christian, Islamic, Judaic, and many other religions idea. Hmm. And the Epicureans made themselves very unpopular for that reason.
Okay. And apparently the unpopularity lasted for several thousand years. Apparently Darwin, when he was preparing his work on evolution, did not refer to Epicurus. Why?
Well, his critics said, this is just Lucretius warmed over. Everybody's heard all this before. So, and in a way they were right, but the refinements and details and conceptual additions that Darwin introduced made it somewhat different from Lucretius's original idea.
All right, so Lucretius and Epicurus before him, thinking in terms of no gods interfering with the universe. The universe is a steady state kind of thing. We talked about ideas on the soul and its source, and at this point in the book, you ask us to consider the Roomba. Why?
The point there, could you give me a bit of context?
Well, the idea being that the Roomba appears to have some sense or a soul or something because of the way it moves around the room and detects things and decides, okay, I'm not going to bump into that. I'm not going to go down the stairs, that sort of thing.
Right. What lesson could we draw from this? Well, that machines can that are purely material in our modern sense, can engage in all sorts of semi-intelligent behavior, and you don't need an incorporeal soul to, have consciousness, to be aware of things, to have rationality.
All right. So then, so we have to consider where things come from within human beings, and there's some sort of atomic source of the soul in Epicurus's mind. We get to the point of the rise of civilization, and with no gods to hand down law and authority, where did Epicurus and Lucretius afterwards say law and authority come from?
Yeah, this is one of the most innovative moves, I think, because most traditions claim that that moral rules and even some political rules represent commandments of God. And the Epicureans said that isn't how it worked. Rather, people came together. First, they were purely solitary creatures, just wandering around the earth on their own. But they began to band together way back ages ago. And at first, it was full of friction and competition and jostling for power and even violence and bloodshed as these groups grew larger and after they invented metal smelting and weapons. And then they must have realized that they needed to introduce moral codes and legal rules and procedures of justice. But they figured this all out by themselves. And so morality is a kind of convention whose purpose is to prevent harm, the harm that one person or one group can do to another. And it's a very simple idea, but I think a very fruitful one.
Well, so when we get into how groups of people deal with each other, did Epicureanism speak directly to inequality and whether it is a feature or a bug?
It's implicitly a very egalitarian philosophy because what it says is that all sorts of distinctions of rank and status and wealth, these are all produced by the decisions people have made and by their perceptions. In a sense, they're unreal. They just exist either in our minds or in practices that we have adopted. But we shouldn't believe in innate inferiority, innate superiority. Those are really superstitious ideas.
Catherine Wilson is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her latest book is called How to Be an Epicurean, The Ancient Art of Living Well, in which she busts up some of the myths of Epicurus from 3rd century BCE Athens and the idea that it's all about eat, drink, and be merry. Obviously, it's a much more encompassing philosophy than that in seeking about pleasure and avoiding pain. Join the conversation on The Exchange. Explore Epicureanism with us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Have there been some significant figures down the years who really did hew to Epicureanism and the writings of Lucretius and Epicurus and try to bring them forward? It seems like not a lot of people have gotten some of the major points here, like the idea of egalitarianism and people not outranking each other. These are things that would have been very attractive in many other philosophies, wouldn't they?
Yeah, you would think so. And certainly in political philosophy, there was enormous influence from Thomas Hobbes, who was trying to reduce the amount of violence and competition in his society by putting in a central authority. You could say that the idea of the UN as a central peacekeeping force comes via Hobbes from Epicurean ideas. Marx would be another person to mention, and the great utilitarian John Stuart Mill. And I think one of the ways in which maybe we'll get onto this shortly, but thinking about death, the way in which we're beginning now to think about death and futility in medical treatment really could benefit from looking back at some of the Epicurean ideas about that.
Well, let's talk about that now, then, death and the Epicurean, because the way I look at it, it seems to be kind of an easy-come, easy-go sort of thing, and I'm obviously watering this way down or distilling it quite a bit, but I mean, the fact is that you take life's things as they come to you, and you deal with what you get, and that this is sort of where it goes at the end, too.
That's right. So the Epicurean idea is that everything has a natural limit, because it's just made of atoms. They're just going to dissipate back into the atmosphere. All your soul atoms will disappear. And so although we find it very hard, as some people often point out, to think, I am mortal, death is something that happens to other people, we have to remember that that is the case. And according to the Epicureans, there's no afterlife, so no reward, no punishment. And the point is to live well, live without harming others, live in an enjoyable way. And in this way, you'll have fewer regrets when it's all over.
And Catherine, you incorporate abortion and infanticide in here and acknowledge that there is no known Epicurean position on them. So how do you extend the philosophy of Epicurus into this realm?
Right. Well, I take it first that not living up to your natural limit is a misfortune. But you have to look at abortion, I think, as a way of preventing serious harm to the woman who is carrying the embryo or the fetus and perhaps the people around her. And granted, harm is done to what is not quite a living organism, but it's justifiable harm. So that's the position I take. And then if the question arises, well, why is an infanticide also morally acceptable? Because there, too, we might be preventing a lot of harm to a mother who's unable to care for the child or can't afford it or something like that. But my argument why infanticide is wrong is that unlike the fetus or the embryo, the child is already part of human society once it's born. And that is an Epicurean thought.
And then you also extend this to suicide and euthanasia. And how do you see those embracing, or how does Epicureanism come into those realms?
Right. Epicureanism is against suicide in most cases. The Stoics, by contrast, thought that if you had a terrible political defeat or lost all your money or were sent into exile, the noble thing to do might be to just kill yourself. Epicureans think that's kind of pointless and wrong. You're probably harming other people in killing yourself. And in just about every case, things get better. They would make an exception, I think, for intractable pain, intractable suffering. Well, you're at the end of your life. There's nothing more the doctors can do. If you ask for some extra morphine, they would certainly not condemn you for doing that. And I think medical thinking is coming around to this, the thought that it's no longer that we should do absolutely everything to prolong life in whatever condition that life is going to be.
Well, and then we get again to the afterlife, which you've mentioned already, but the theme of Epicureanism thus far seems to be that seeing is believing. So if you don't see that there is an afterlife, does that mean there isn't one?
There isn't one because there's no God to bring it about. And because physically what happens when you die is that your atoms dissipate into nature and become the basis of new objects and perhaps new people and animals.
Our discussion about suicide, euthanasia, abortion, infanticide prompted a question from Jamie in Medford, Catherine, who wants to know the Epicurean standpoint on the death penalty.
Well, technically, I don't think they wrote about that. Though Epicurus did say something that touches on that. He said that the person who breaks laws, who harms others, could be seen as a wild animal. It sounds a bit harsh to me. Personally, I'm against the death penalty. I don't think it's a deterrent. I don't think it's prevents other people from murdering other people. All the evidence is against its usefulness as a deterrent. And I don't think that arguments from sheer desert work either. But I would find it, I think, a little hard to justify that view just on the basis of Epicurean philosophy.
Let's talk about the heart of Epicurean philosophy then, because we haven't quite gotten to this point yet. We mentioned the fact that it's not just about food and drink. I mean, that there's a frequent confusion here with hedonism, and you're saying that technically Epicureans are hedonists?
That's right, because hedonism just means the view that pleasure is the greatest good and pain the greatest evil to be avoided.
All right. So, but Epicureanism is hedonism, and then a bunch more.
Yes, it's prudent hedonism, because it's pretty clear. Most people can testify to this from their own experience, that if you just go all out in the things that are thought to bring us pleasure, lots of food, lots of sweet food, lots of alcohol, lots of drugs, lots of sex, you're going to bring about lots of pains and discomforts on yourself and probably do some harm to other people as well. So they're both prudential reasons and moral reasons not to grasp at every kind of pleasure and go for the maximum amount, because you're just not going to get it. Moderation and reflection and really thinking about the things that do bring you pleasure is the way to go.
Okay, so where concerns food and drink, which is the place where most people seem to think they know Epicurus and Epicureanism, the idea is, yeah, enjoy what's in front of you, but don't enjoy it too much so that you'll end up causing yourself some pain later.
Well, you can enjoy it as much as you want, but don't enjoy too much of it.
All right. Well, so the more we get into the idea of choosing pleasure and avoiding pain, it appears this is really about living in the moment, doing things now, keep what's working, dispose of what isn't.
Yes, you could put it that way. But you're also thinking about the consequences of your choices. What will happen if I live on a diet of potato chips and candy bars and fizzy drinks? These may bring immediate gratification, but in the long run, they're going to ruin your health.
So then, Catherine, beyond food, drink, and those sorts of immediate pleasures that generally go in the mouth, does the philosophy speak to material things? It appears to value pleasurable experience above having nice stuff.
That's right. And Epicurus lived and taught in a garden. Not a flower garden, because gardens in those days didn't have flowers. But he thought that what was really pleasant was learning, trying to figure things out for yourself, reading, talking about philosophical issues, having simple communal meals, and spending a lot of time out of doors. And I think in Oregon you can relate to that. I haven't had a chance to mention that I'm an actual old Oregon person. I taught at University of Eugene for 14 years.
Oh, well, you're talking to Eugene right now, because we're on the air there too as well, so good to know. So where Epicureanism gets outside the self and then begins to direct attention to the other people in the world, does Epicureanism say limit your pleasure if it causes pain to another?
Absolutely, yes. That's the fundamental ethical rule, is try not to harm others. And, of course, there are trade-offs. If I apply for a job and get it, somebody else doesn't get it and is thereby made miserable. So we have to leave some space for competition, right? Zero-sum games. But we should limit it. And this also governs the way they think about social inequality. A modern Epicurean thinks about social inequality. It's not just about a race to the top, but about preventing the harms that you're doing as side effects that are not intended, but that come out of the kinds of institutions that we have.
And how does the morality of Epicureanism compare with some of the other philosophies and traditions? You mentioned the Stoics a while back and some differences there.
Right. Epicureanism is very different from Platonism. Plato thought that there were virtues that were sort of transcendental. They existed in some kind of heaven. And that you just had to remember the basic virtues, courage and temperance and wisdom. and you didn't really have to think about particular actions, particular choices. Whereas the Epicurean stress is really on your free will, your choosing, your reflecting, making rational decisions rather than venerating certain virtues and avoiding certain vices.
Was Platonism more of a religious sort of philosophy? Is it more of a religious philosophy?
No, it's more transcendental.
Okay.
But I think the big difference is to religious ethics, where ethics is seen as a list of commandments that if you break them, you'll get punished for them, if not in this life, in another life. And a kind of, the New Testament New Testament morality is actually much more Epicurean than Old Testament morality. There are even some people who think, maybe Jesus was a little influenced by Epicurean ideas.
They wouldn't have been very old by the time that he was on the earth. So
that's right. Yeah.
So you do come back to the concept of justice many times, Catherine. So how might an Epicurean view of justice change our society today?
Epicurus says justice is a convention to prevent harm, and that justice is not fixed for all time, but it has to change and adapt as circumstances change and as what people know changes. So this is a really very fruitful way to look at it, because so many things that we took for granted as just and rational in times past, like segregation, like the exclusion of women, have really changed because of what we now know and of what we now consider to be possible and therefore fair. So I think we're going to see massive changes. I hope we're going to see massive changes in the way we think about the environment, in the way we think about gun control, in the way we think about warfare and nuclear war. We're going to, I think, see many of these policies that we now take for granted as really irrational and destructive.
But not without a bit of resistance from the people who hold very tightly to them, particularly when you talk about changing circumstances. I find myself thinking of the originalists who view the Constitution as just the words you got there on the paper.
Exactly. And an Epicurean is really kind of skeptical about basing politics on rights. I think where rights do serve a function, they're a sort of shorthand for policies that prevent harm. But when they're just taken as idols that we should hew to just because somebody in completely different circumstances enunciated them, that really is irrational and harmful.
Which brings us to part four of the book about the self in a complex world, and you begin with science here. Do the Epicureans line up with the scientists or the skeptics or whoever they feel is right?
They were very scientifically minded because they wanted to explain everything in terms of atoms. And of course, that was difficult. In some cases, it was easier to explain contagion in terms of little particles floating through the air, but pretty difficult to explain the orbits of the moon or the rising and setting of the sun. But an Epicurean perspective involves realizing that that reality is really complicated because there's so many tiny little invisible mechanisms that are determining our health, that are determining what's happening in the atmosphere and underground. And we have no direct insight into them. We can only get at them indirectly through scientific method. So I really stress in the second part of the book, having on one hand a lot of trust in science because its methods have been refined over many centuries, and at the same time realizing that of course, we're going to be confused by some things like medical advice because we don't yet really understand how all these little particles and systems and mechanisms are working. That's why we get different diet advice every week in the newspaper. This week you can eat eggs. Next week you shouldn't eat eggs.
You noticed that too, yeah. Well, there's certainly another major source of skepticism in the world today, and that's, of course, the internet, which gives people the ability to broadcast any thinking, complete or not, to the world. How would you apply an Epicurean approach to that?
Oh, my goodness, yes. And then this new regulation by Facebook that there's no problem with politicians saying false things. It's become a massive problem that we just didn't anticipate. The Epicurean says, be critical, look for evidence, insist on evidence, check your sources, ask yourself who might be benefiting from claiming this, and in general, be very cautious wherever political interests or financial interests are involved, wherever you have reason to think that somebody isn't just objectively and disinterestedly interested in the truth.
So an Epicurean approach would be follow the money, in essence?
Look for the financial interest.
And how would an Epicurean approach the way in which we don't even seem to have one set of facts that works for everybody? I mean, you deal with the fact that we have perhaps a lot of people think like Epicureans, but a lot of people with other philosophies in the world.
Right. Well, on one hand, there's in many regions there's room for different interpretations, different perspectives. We can tell very different stories about history, and sometimes we don't know which account is true. For instance, did slavery disappear mainly because of moral arguments against it in this country, or did it mainly disappear because of financial arguments against it? It wasn't seen as profitable anymore. And historians can argue about which is the correct account of what happened. But some things are just plainly false and insisted to be true because somebody is benefiting from maintaining the falsehood.
We have skipped completely over love and have just a few seconds to address that. Would a typical Epicurean approach to love be, if it works for you, go for it, and if not, avoid it?
That's a pretty good summary. I think also expect jealousy, expect suffering. It's not going to be a free ride, but there's really nothing like it.
You say that at the in the beginning of the book that you expect readers to roll their eyes at some of my opinions, so you're welcoming people to take things with a grain of salt, which I think is what a good Epicurean would do, and the other people can choose for themselves what works for them and what to avoid. It's a very complete look at Epicureanism. The book is called How to Be an Epicurean, The Ancient Art of Living Well. Catherine Wilson, the author and our guest. Catherine, thank you so much for sharing this with us.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Take care.